President.
Mr. Swanson, rewind. How and when did you come to join the forces, please?
I joined the Territorial Army. I think it would be in March or April. I'm not sure the exact date. March or April 39.
Why did you join up?
Well, I belonged to a small village, Castletown, Caithness. And I suppose the recruiting sergeant had come along to us and not having a great lot to do in a place like that. We were, you know, interested in itself for joining up for the training, for being able to, quite interested in shooting, of course, things like that. And this was initially...
What unit was this?
It's the 5th Battalion Seaforth Highlanders. It was a territorial battalion. And the one different thing about it was that it had a different badge to all the other Seaforth units. It had a round badge with a wildcat, and the motto was sans peur, a French for aye, without fear. But all the other Seaforth units had the stag's head badge. And I think this was not positive about this, but I think the reason for this was the 5th Battalion was a battalion raised by, I think, probably the Duke of Sutherland or someone like that, which in effect had been more or less a sort of, in the old days, a sort of private unit. And this is how they had a different badge to the rest of the Seaforth.
Did you see any action with them?
No. I was with the 5th Seaforth until probably around about July 40 when I volunteered for the commandos. They were recruiting for the commandos at that time. And I volunteered and was accepted.
Why did you volunteer for the commandos?
Again, we were having a fairly humdrum existence, as you might say, in the army. You know what I mean? Mainly just doing guards and mostly... doing guards with a rifle but no ammunition, so I think I almost got into trouble there by asking if the Germans knew that they had to wait until we went to the drill hall to collect our bandolier of 50 rounds before we could start. And me and that, plus the fact that I suppose probably joining the army, not necessarily thinking about faraway places, but you know, we were mainly billeted in that area. In fact, I was on guard duties up at Wick, I think in Newton Hill they called it, a wireless station, and that was just about 15 miles from my home village. And this is probably the reason why some of us decided when we saw it up on the notice board that whoever commanders were being informed and asking for volunteers.
Was it easy to get into the commandos?
Well, probably at that time, you didn't get anything. You were mainly just asked your reason for joining, things like this, if you could swim, and that, and the interview. And I think, as far as I can recall, all the chaps who volunteered along with me from the 5th Seaforth were all accepted. And the 11th Scottish Commander was formed again, and were formed into different troops. And as far as possible, all the troops were of the same unit, as far as possible. Like, I was the 6th troop, and it was all Seaforths. There might be another troop with probably mainly Gordons, maybe another troop mainly Cameronians, as far as possible. And there was quite a lot of ex-cavalry men had volunteered for the commandos. And that was formed down in Gala Shields, outside Edinburgh. And the first thing we did was a march from Gala Shields right across to Ayr, right across Scotland. Not all that far, but, you know, if you're not used to it, and, you know, just camping in different places. Every night went to Biggar, I think it was, Douglas, Muirchurt, Cumnock, and then on to Ayr. And from there we went down, I forget which seaport it was, but it probably somewhere like... Ardross at some point, and was shipped across to Arran, and we did all our training on the island of Arran, which is a fairly rugged, mountainous sort of island. Well, one half is that. In fact, they say nowadays that is almost, you know, shows two different things. One side is the rugged, mountainous side, and the other side is the sort of cultivated, as what you would call almost the lowland side of it. And as I said, we were either billeted in hotels or in private houses.
What was commando training like on Arran?
Well, I quite enjoyed it. It was fairly stiff, as you might say. A lot of hard marches, a lot of scrambling about in the hills and the dark and that sort of thing. Also, training, going down the scrambling nets from ships into boats. I think, in fact, I think there were some big knobs, as you might say, come up once to watch one of that operations that we did at night, you know, and one of the first times, and I think myself it was a complete fiasco.
Why?
I mean, you imagine, you know, coming down a scrambling net. It's like when you see them doing in the scrambling nets in the Crypton Factor, it takes a bit of know-how and practice to be able to get up it and down it quickly, you know, and you can imagine us trying to, I think it was probably about the second attempt, and doing it in the dark, trying to get down there with your pack on, your rifle, steel helmet. So, and plus the fact, you know, I mean, that if the sea was slightly choppy and the boat was heaving a bit, and then the small boat that you were going into, and we didn't have the, you know, the really proper landing craft at that time, you know, it was early days. So we are trying to do this almost in rowing boats.
How soon after you got to Arran Island did this visit by the Knobs occur?
I wouldn't like to be sure, but probably only a matter of 2 months, maybe not even that.
So it was late in 1940, mm-hmm. in the winter?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Who were the Knobs?
Well, I'm not quite sure. So the rumour was that... what's the name would have been there? Keyes, Admiral Keyes. But the talk went that there was high-ranking officers, and Churchill was there. But I don't know, that was the talk that went about, but I've been reading quite a few books about it, and I see in quite a number of books it mentions that Churchill went up somewhere in the Orkneys and that, you know, when the commanders were practicing and that. So whether it was true that he was in Arran, you know, I wouldn't like to say, but that was the rumour that went around amongst the troops at the time.
Did you do any operations with 11 Commando?
No, not actually. I think to mention is it probably comes up in other research at the time. When we went abroad from Arran with the Commando, it had been early, but January 41, I'm not quite sure of the dates, I haven't got a good memory for that, and I didn't keep a diary, but the boats that you probably find mentioned in other things like Crete and different things, so there was three Glen boats, there was a Glen Gael, a Glen Erin, and the Glen Roy. I'll always remember that, we were on the Glen Gael. It's maybe not relevant, but one reason I do remember them as well is because when their first landfall was at Cape Town, and the folk there used to meet all the boats and, you know, take you out and entertain you. And it was great there because if Cape Town was all lit up, which was, you know, a great sight after the blackout. And when we got back from having a day's visit in this family, took us back to the dock gates. And we went in there and, of course, asked, you know, for the boat, you know, and we weren't quite sure. They should have been saying ship rather than the boat. We got directed to the Glen Roy, and by the time we found the Glen Gael, it was past midnight, so that was our leave cancelled, you know, because we had to report back by midnight, but the only reason was because there were three identical boats, more or less, and we got directed to the wrong one, so that's how we finished up. But I believe the Glen Erin had a great existence. It had been probably at Crete and that, and it actually went out to the Far East. There's a book written by someone, I think it's called Forsex. Have you heard of it?
Yes.
And I think you'd find that the Glen Erin is mentioned as only one of the ships that was really suitable for what they were trying to do. So we landed in up the Suez Canal. I think it was a transit camp, Geneva or some name like that. And from there we did some training in the desert and that, and I think this is probably when the evacuation from Greece was on. And we were sent to Cyprus, which, as I say, was probably just a sort of garrison troops, and we spent quite some time there doing training as well. And then the only action that the 11th Scottish Commando was involved in, as far as I'm aware, was this landing in Syria at the Litani River. And
how is it that you didn't go on that?
Well, the reason was, as I say, we were due to go on, but there was a troop or troops were to be held in reserve. And as it so happened, our officer, there was two officers per troop, but the Captain Blair was the chief officer, and he took ill just the day of the landing, and we were put back as one of the troops being held in reserve, so therefore I didn't see any action at all with the London Scottish Commander, because we were stationed round about in different places. Indeed, we were round outside Alexandria in some places, and it came about that the unit was being disbanded, and this was when Captain Blair interviewed us all, and one of the things that he had mentioned, it was a unit called the Long Range Desert Group asking for volunteers. He didn't know a great lot about it, but they were supposed to operate behind the lines. And one of the things not required for that initially, but one of the things that they were looking for was drivers. And I had passed a test with the 5th Sea Force, so therefore I had an army license, and so he put me down for the LRDG. There was about six or seven of us from 11 Scottish went to the LRDG, and quite a number went to the SAS. What happened to the rest? I never met up with any of them, but I met up obviously with a lot of the chaps in the SAS.
How long after the Litani River did you volunteer for the Long Range Desert Group? How long would it have been? How many months?
Well, to be quite honest, as I say, my memory is not just too good in that, but it could only have been a matter of maybe 2 months, maybe not that, because, as I say, as far as I can recall, we didn't do anything after the Litani River, and it was just a case we were waiting about, so I suppose it was the powers that be were deciding what to do with us, and it had been decided that we would be disbanded.
Did you have an interview with somebody to get into the LRDG?
Yes. Actually, I had an interview with, as he was then, Captain David Lloyd Owen. But it was only quite some time after that I realised that Captain Lloyd Owen himself had just joined the LRDG. What put it into mind was actually a very nice chap, that, but he didn't seem to tell us an awful lot about the LRDG and that. And if you've read his book, it tells you that when he did join it, he sort of, I don't know if he said he made a mistake, but what he did was he stood back and sort of watched, you know, when they were, I think the first place they went probably was down to Kufra, which was down the Nile, and then through the desert. And this hadn't gone down very well, as he says in his book, with whoever was keeping an eye on him. But this is why he didn't tell us a great lot about the LRDG, because he was just a volunteer and being accepted himself. I don't know whether it was only maybe a week or two before we arrived there.
But you had no difficulty getting into it.
Well, I would say, initially I was put as a driver to a Major Wilson, I believe, who won the BC. And this was in the Abbasiyah barracks in Cairo. This is where we were sent to when we went to join the LRDG. But a day or two after that, I don't know what had happened, but they must have been required a driver in A Squadron. And they were at the Citadel in Cairo. And I was sent up there to be a driver to a Major Don Steele, New Zealand Squadron. So that's how I said the first 18 months, I think, with the LRDG I spent with headquarters A Squadron.
Can you tell me more about the composition of A Squadron?
Well, A Squadron was just the same as B. There was, I forget how many, there were probably four or five patrols. And patrol could vary from, depend on the job, maybe just four trucks, four men on each truck. Or maybe sometimes five, six trucks, just depending. But I wouldn't be, you know what I mean, be just absolutely ginned up on that to a certain, you know what I mean.
But they were all supposed to be New Zealanders in escort.
No, what it was, New Zealand. They were New Zealanders. All that was headquarters were mainly, say, British, like it covers the four countries. And the other ones that were British were fitters, you know, engine fitters. They looked after the trucks and the signalmen. They were British. The rest were drivers, gunners, navigators, were New Zealand. But it all, and the other thing that probably was sometimes was not New Zealand, might have been the, you know, the medical orderly. See, I think at that time the New Zealanders weren't just too keen on having, you know, too many men away from their own divisions, you know, in that. And this is probably why the mechanics and the signalers were usually, I think, I was almost in all cases, were from British units.
What kind of things did you have to drive?
Well, at that time, when they started off, they had 30 hundredweight Fords trucks. And also in the HQ, they had what you call the heavy section, and that was for, you know, bringing in the supplies, whether it was to, you know, whatever ages, whether it was Siwa, Kufra, Jal, or whatever. But it's mainly Siwa and Kufra early days. And they had 10-ton, two 10-ton American vehicles, they were called. One was a Mack, M-A-C-P, and the other one was a White, which is just W-H-I-T-E name. That was it. Plus, you might have had 3-ton vehicles, again, in headquarters for the supply. But the trucks that actually went out on patrol were almost just the 30 hundredweights. They carried all the water, petrol, rations that they required for each strip, usually. They also had built up over a period of time what you might call caches of supplies in the desert in different places. Because there was a chap there, Ken Lazarus was his name, he was New Zealander and he was a surveyor, and he mapped a great lot of the desert where we were operating and things like that. And they had established different places where they, you know, cairns where they could, you know, leave supplies of petrol and water, you know, in case of emergency. They did have quite a few of them dotted around in different places.
How long was it before you went out on operations with them?
I wasn't on operations, as I say, I was headquarters. You might have gone out part of the way, you know what I mean? Sometimes, depending on what the job was, if they were going to be away for a long time and that, you might be sent out with a truck or two trucks, just carrying supplies, which they would use for the first week or so. And once that was finished, you just returned to headquarters. As I say, I was in all the time I was in the desert with the LRDG, mainly I was in either headquarters, A Squadron, or after Major Steele had left New Zealand Squadron, I was transferred then to B Squadron, which was the British side, as you might say, but again in headquarters.
Do you remember when you were transferred from A to B?
Pardon?
Do you remember when it was that you were transferred from A to B?
Well, it would be probably about 18 months after joining, which would be in the end of 42, somewhere there, but I wouldn't be positive about the dates, but it would be roughly something like that.
Did you find much difference between A and B squadrons?
Not a lot, because actually, although the New Zealanders maybe were to a certain extent more free and easy, they had a different attitude, you know what I mean, to their officers and everything, but they still were very disciplined, you know what I mean? They might have probably a New Zealand officer or would speak to his men in an entirely different way to what a British officer would. Although, again, the British officers in the LRDG, them who sort of made the grade, had to be, you know, mix in more with the men than you would do in a normal unit. I mean, you didn't have to salute them every time you saw them and things like that. And usually the officer in a LRDG patrol was usually called the skipper. And that's how he was usually addressed. But you know, in the everyday running of the patrol, you didn't have to go up and click your heels and salute before you addressed them. You know what I mean? You could just walk up and ask him whatever you wanted to ask, address him as skipper. This would seem to be the favourite term. Well, of course, an officer who went out on patrol there, he lived whatever the length of the patrol was. He just lived with the men, bunked with the men, slept next to them, just day in, day out. So there's no way you could carry on the thing. But you're still disciplined enough to... It wasn't a case of you pleased yourself, but the sort of regimental formalities were dispensed with while you were out on patrol. Let's put it that way. I think I'd be correct in saying that.
Did that suit you?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did, because I think to a certain extent sometimes you had a feeling, if you had maybe a slightly independent mind, that whether they meant to or not, some officers seemed to address you as if you had very little intelligence.
In an ordinary regiment, you mean?
Yes, exactly. Whether they had to do that to supposedly keep the step difference between you, or whether they did it through the training that was instilled in them when they were going through the officers' training thing. This was the way to address the men.
But you felt that in the LRDG you were more respected?
Yes, definitely. I mean, say, I read a book not very long ago. It was about... the midget submarines that went in to torpedo the Tirpitz. And there was a foreword in that book. It was about a chap named, can I mind his name, like Henty Cree or some strange sort of name. I think it was Australian, who had volunteered for this. And this officer who had interviewed him had said in the book that he was quite surprised. He found that he could, you know what I mean, what he meant was that he could carry on, this chap could carry on a conversation with him, you know what I mean, in his level. So that must have been an officer assumed that everyone else down below was a moron. And I thought it rather strange that you would actually include that in your book, because I thought it was in very bad taste. I could be wrong.
But this is what the type of thing you had found yourself from ordinary regiments.
No, I wouldn't put it that way, but there was no doubt about that in an ordinary regiment, not only from the officers, probably from the RSMs and the sergeants. I mean, so you had to be on your toes at all times. But maybe this was because it's a different setup, maybe in your battalion or regiment. You're all together and maybe disciplined. But when you are more or less just a party of 10, 12 men or something like that, living together, and as you might say, and out on patrol miles into the desert, there was no time for it. There was no need for it. And yet there was still discipline. Don't get me wrong. As I say, there was still... And of course, the more you went with an officer on that, the more you got to know him, and probably the more you respected him. Because I think in an ordinary regiment, you never really got to know your officers, really got to know them. As I say, because you never got a chance to engage in conversation with them. It just wasn't done.
So in the LRDG, you still obeyed the orders of...
Oh, yes. Oh, there was no question of... I thought it was free and easy as that goes. Oh, no, there was no question. You in fact, you probably did it much better than when you were doing it under duress. You know what I mean? Sometimes, you know... Even though you probably know it yourself, you used to get what they think was the typical sergeant. They always should have had a bit ball in the pitch of his voice. But I mean, see, as I say, probably this is the army and this is the thing, but it's not necessary.
Did the people in the ordinary regiments in North Africa resent what they regarded as the special status of the LRDG?
Well, of course, we went in very close contact with the other units, if you get what I mean, because usually you were, operating from either an oasis somewhere well away from the beaten track, but probably sometimes, yes, when if you're on leave and that, sometimes maybe they did sort of, well, I don't know if they resented you, they probably ended you. Because at that time as well, when you're out in the desert, you were allowed to grow a beard. You didn't have to shave every... Well, you could, really, because water was of the utmost importance that you... It was very frugal with it. There was no way you could be allowed water for washing and shaving.
You said that you didn't go out on operations with them in the desert.
Not actual, no, no.
So what kind of work would you typically do?
Well, as I say, you were just there as in the headquarters as supply. You probably had to go to the different places picking up the supplies and that sort of thing. And as I say, sometimes going out part of the way with them, but not actually going all the way, you see.
What kind of terrain would you be driving over then?
It varied almost from, you know, I mean, nice level, hard sand, to soft sand, to sand dunes. I remember once, I think it was way down in the Kufra, where we came across, you can come across some very, very rough terrain, you know what I mean, with broken stones, and I think we came through what appeared to be, I think at that there was been a petrified forest. And you can imagine the stumps all over the place. It's quite difficult. So there could be great variations in the going, as we used to call it. You know, I mean, sometimes you get nice smooth sand where you could get along. Next time you could get really soft stuff going through this, what they call the Kalasana sand sea, which was very soft.
Which sand sea?
I think it's... I better look that up.
It's all right, it doesn't matter.
There was a sand sea that when you went in the Asia, Kufra, going up, heading up towards the coast, there was this belt of sand, well, a sand sea as they called it, which you almost had to go through. And of course, some of the officers that had been through there fairly often could find a fairly good running hard sand in it. But if you didn't know your way, you had to do an awful lot of digging. And especially if you're the 3-tonners or the 10-tonners, you can imagine if you hit a soft spot with them, you really had to get the, you know, where you'd have sand channels, probably about 6 feet long metal channels.